Hello, everyone. I'm Tom Schlesinger, and I'm very happy to be talking today with Catherine Han, the producer of A Wrinkle in Time that will be opening tomorrow night. And Catherine, thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your journey to getting this amazing novel by Madeleine L'Engle brought to the screen.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for asking me to be here.
I want to talk about how we recently met again after many years, I love the story because I was at a visual effects conference that our mutual friend Rita Cahill had organized, and I was with my friend Jim, and we decided at lunchtime to go sit in the corner so it'd be quiet where we can talk. And then, soon after that, you and Sid Gannis and Rita came over and asked to sit at the table. And I just remember there were these moments where we were like looking at each other, like, is this someone from a past lifetime, or is this, that there was like this kind of recognition of seeing each other for, after many years.
Yeah, and the thing that I remember too is that I looked at you and I knew you, but there was this other piece that I liked you. Like there was, you can have this feeling of, even if it's someone from your past, like, oh my God, I know it's someone from my past, but either he said something terrible to me or I said something terrible to her. But when I saw you, I just thought, oh yeah, oh, we're friends. I could not place exactly where it was. And then it was just so crazy that here we were meeting while I was in the midst of the production of A Wrinkle in Time. And, how many years ago? 30 years ago, maybe, we met. And I was kind of talking to you, and you were helping me look at A Wrinkle in Time through the lens of the hero's journey.
That's right.
And I loved it. I remember loving the time I spent with you. So it was really fun to reconnect the way we did.
Yeah, there's that moment of recognition where it's almost like, I was kind of looking at you, and it was like there was this familiarity. And you're right. There is a kind of, you have to decide whether you want to raise the Star Trek deflector shield if it's you had a bad experience.
I know. No, my star shield reflector shield was down. I was ready to engage, It was fun to talk and fun to reminisce. And it was just like a really wonderful moment where we got to meet again after all those years.
Yeah, and continues to be. I've talked to you about this, Catherine, but my brother Jim and sister Linda and I a couple of years ago decided to start a family business that we're calling Student Storytellers, and the main intention is that we want to talk with professionals like you to talk about your journey to, in this case, getting A Wrinkle in Time made, so they can have a sense of what it's like to kind of move from academia into film and television.
My story is a little bit of an extreme. Journey to get a movie made takes as long as mine did with A Wrinkle in Time. But there are projects out there that people have spent decades trying to get made.
Right. I think some great films have taken many years, like Cuckoo's Nest took a long time to get made, for example, and went through different iterations as well. And so maybe we can go back to when did you first read Madeleine L'Engle's book, A Wrinkle in Time?
I first read A Wrinkle in Time when I was about 10 years old, and I wasn't a great reader, but when this librarian gave me this book to read, I remember she asked me, what kind of books do you like to read? And I said, well, I don't like to read. I like to play handball. And she said, well, I think you might like this book called A Wrinkle in Time. It recently won the Newbery Award. And it's about a girl just like you. So that was kind of intriguing. And that night I started it, and I just couldn't put it down. I loved it. I just fell in love with Meg, with Charles Wallace, with Calvin, with all the characters and the story itself. It was a great cosmic adventure. and these three otherworldly creatures that happened to be women were taking them on this grand journey to find the missing father. And when I finished the book, I just loved it. And all I could think was, what a fantastic movie. That
wow.
is what I thought when I was 10 years old. And
wow.
I started a letter to Walt Disney to tell him about the book, because there was no one else I knew that made movies for children in those days. It was only Walt Disney. And so I started the letter, and then I was too shy to send it. And then a couple of years later, he died. And I was so sad. I think the Wonderful World of Color would come into our homes every Sunday night. I loved all of his movies. I was a particular huge fan of Hayley Mills. And when he died, it was just, I took it very personally, and I also felt very, very guilty that I had not sent him that letter. Why I felt that, I do not know, but that's what I felt. And I could not, I didn't know anybody else to tell, because I hadn't sent that letter, now I felt a real need to tell somebody else about the book. And I didn't know anyone, so I decided right there, I made a promise to myself that when I grew up, I would make the movie. And that was about 50 years ago.
That is amazing. That is just amazing. So that was your call to adventure.
It was my call to
first
adventure.
First 10 and then when you were 12 to make the film. And then when did you next kind of pick up the idea that you wanted to make this into a film?
Well, it was about 13 years later. I had the great opportunity to work with a writer-producer by the name of Norman Lear, who at the time was really at the peak of his career. He had like 10 TV shows on the air, 6 of which were in the top 10. 60 million people a week watched his television program, All in the Family. So he was a terrific teacher, mentor. And my job, I did many things, but one of the jobs was to read material for him. And I got the courage to ask him to read A Wrinkle in Time. And he said he really loved it, but he didn't see it something for him to write or direct. And just in that nanosecond, I said, well, can I go after the rights anyway? Because I was not looking for things to do outside of what Norman would do. But I just jumped at that opportunity. And he said, well, if you can get the president of the company, who was Alan Horn in that time, to agree, yes, you can go after the rights. So I sent the book straight away to Alan, and a month later, he wrote me a note back, and he said, I loved it. Don't know how you're going to make it, but go for it. And so with those three words, go for it, I sent a letter to Madeline L'Engle, tracked down her home address, and there was no internet, no email, nothing. I was looking through yellow pages in New York trying to figure out what her address was. So I sent the letter to her, and about a week later, I get a collect call from Madeline L'Engle, and would I accept it? All these years, I had just loved this book so much and really looked up to this woman named Madeline L'Engle. And to get a collect call from her, I was just kind of speechless. So I did. I asked her if I could come meet with her and discuss the possibility of optioning the film rights. And she agreed. And so several days later, I was on a plane for New York and met with her. And at lunch, come to find out that over the years, hundreds of people had wanted the rights, and she always said no. And for whatever reason, whatever happened in that lunch, 6 months later, Norman Lear and Alan Horn's company had the rights to A Wrinkle in Time. That was like in 1979. Mm-hmm. So from 1979 on is when I was really, trying to get this movie made.
And do you have a sense at all, Catherine, about what it was that kind of tipped her towards saying yes to you and Norman Lear on this, and also then how did your relationship with her unfold after that?
Yes, I think, Madeline L'Engle can only answer that, but
yes.
I think it was a combination of a couple of things. One, I think that I walked into that luncheon with her working for Norman Lear, who was at the time extremely successful, famous television producer, who had also made movies, but he was also very well regarded in mm-hmm. the community outside of television, you know, that he was really doing good work. So that was a plus. The other was that I happened to be in the right place at the right time because I was the young girl of the very first generation that was influenced by that book. And so I think there may have been other people that came to her over the years, but no one that I, to my knowledge, that had this incredible childlike sense of the story mm-hmm. and connected with someone who could open doors. So there was this combination of credibility and commitment. And the joy and the excitement, enthusiasm from a young woman who really wanted to make good on that childhood promise. And I think, you know, she appreciated the combination. And I don't know all of what I said at lunch that moved her so, but there was some sort of connection because sometimes when the business affairs would fall apart, she would call me or I would call her.
Yeah.
And we would have a conversation as a sidebar, and then we would make things work. So there was always this trust between the two of mm-hmm. us that just yeah. deepened over the years.
I see. And what were her requests as far as did she have what was her creative input, and did she have the right to say the script isn't working for me, I don't want to move forward with this? What was your relationship like in terms of the development of the script?
So one of the reasons why she would never sign any kind of agreement prior to our meeting is because she always demanded a clause in uh-huh. any contract that you cannot change character or theme. And okay. no company would agree to those terms.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, Norman Lear's company agreed to the terms. And so in the beginning, there was always this clause that you can't change character or theme. Now, kind of a vague, because what does that really mean? And mm-hmm. I think what it really means is it kind of puts a brake on any kind of development of the story that so gets so far away from the intention of the original work.
Mm-hmm.
And I never wanted to get away from the story. I never could understand why the clause was a deal breaker.
Yeah.
Because my whole interest was doing a movie that, you know, I could get A Wrinkle in Time up on the screen. In the beginning, it was very, very difficult because it over time, I came to understand how important this story was to her. I mean,
yeah.
this was a very important story. She wrote it at a very raw time in her life. It was a way of really kind of her search for meaning and purpose in the universe.
Mm.
And then we all got to benefit from that. So this story and every specific thing about it was really important to her. And it became difficult in the beginning to change anything. You know, she would get really upset. She never had script mm-hmm. approval or anything like that.
Right.
But I always thought she was a really important touchstone, you know, my tuning fork. Like, you always need someone that you know believes in you and wants you to succeed, but can also talk straight to you and say, oh, that's really, you know, it's going to lead you into a dead end. And Madeline was that. You know, I didn't want to disappoint her.
Sure, sure.
But she never had any of those approvals, you know.
Right,
it was,
right.
You know, she trusted me and I trusted her.
Mm-hmm. And so if for example, a studio wanted to change the main character to Calvin or something like that, I'm sure she was kind of concerned that you know, that would shift the whole momentum of the story for her.
Absolutely. So exactly. Yeah. So let's say, for example, many, many times, if people are listening to this and they're familiar with the story of A Wrinkle in Time, one of the key moments is they have to test her off Kamazoth. Charles Wallace is captured by the dark evil force. And Meg is really disappointed that her father has left him there, and she's very angry with him. And we come to find out that the dark force is within her, and she has to be healed. But the real turning point in this story is when Meg has to accept that her father cannot go back and save Charles Wallace, mm-hmm. and that she has to accept the responsibility and take that leap of faith that even if she doesn't know how to do it, she has this sense of courage that she's going to go and try. And I have been in, so it's very important where this young girl can do something her father cannot do and has to go back on her own to save her brother. But I've been in a lot of conversations where people would say, well, the father should go with her because there's just no way a father would let a daughter do that.
Right.
And when they would say things like that, I thought, oh, you don't understand what this story is about.
Yeah.
Now, this is the true heroine's journey. And in that journey, the young girl goes through all of these various stages, but then she ultimately has to reemerge and, you know, go and save the day or finish the task because of who she is. And that's what Meg has to do. And so that was very difficult. I would say that was very, very difficult to get ever in, people to accept that moment.
Yes,
I'm so sure that's why Madeline wanted that clause, because she probably thought, well, geez, if someone makes this movie and has father go back and help Meg save Charles Wallace, they don't understand what my book is about at all. So
yes,
I can see why she wanted that clause.
Yeah, I understand that. And there's an interesting parallel to being on the journey to get a film made or having a script produced or even, you know, as an actor or an actress in their journey to be in film and television. And something that I realized, and my mentor actually really kind of helped me with all of this, is that I had had some, you know, films that I had written that, you know, everybody was saying were going to be successful, and they actually weren't successful. And I was going, you know, you and I have talked about this, but when you face disappointment, and I want to hear a little bit more about some of the obstacles you faced along the way, it's very easy to kind of go down into the rabbit hole and be depressed and you know, feel kind of trapped around how to actually move forward. And with the help of my mentor, you know, what I learned was there was a part of me that wanted to be rescued and saved, either by mm-hmm. a big production company or a studio. And, you know, in the end, we know, and in light of the heroine's journey, that it's really about finding your voice and expressing your voice and having support in doing that. So if Meg's father kind of helped her in this journey, it would really be kind of, you know, counter to what actually happens in real life. And
exactly.
That in the end, yeah. So I'm kind of curious, you know, that when you had experiences along the way with big disappointments, you know, how did you move through all of those?
Well, I've had so many moments of disappointment and sadness. There are too many to count.
Uh-huh.
And honestly, in the beginning, disappointment, rejection was really stung. It was
mm-hmm.
very hard.
Yeah.
And I think that you are right. I think oftentimes what's connected to that disappointment is that somehow you'll be rescued if people love your work.
Yep.
You know, you don't have to do it. Life's not going to be difficult because you'll just be a success and everything will just fall into place and you'll live happily ever after. And
right,
so when
right.
you're rejected and people do not like your work or they don't like your ideas, you know, life becomes so difficult and you think, oh my God, I'm not being, you know, now it's up to me. And that's it's a process to learn how to deal with that. I do think that I got to a place where I became a little bit more comfortable with being disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I did not continue this journey just receiving rejection and disappointment. One of the things that, and I have to say this to anyone who has a project, it's, you know, getting it made, you may be the very first person that loves something, but if you want to get it made, there better be 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 of you. Mm-hmm. Because the whole idea that, I mean, I felt like I was sold a bill of goods a long time ago when someone said, oh, it's just your passion, you know, you go for it, do everything, and it's all about you. And what
right.
I came to understand is that, yes, it's about you in the beginning. But then for it to have legs and for it to go beyond your dream, it has to have a lot of other people that share that dream.
Mm-hmm.
And so while I had trouble getting, you know, the movie made, the comments that I would get from people who loved A Wrinkle in Time,
yeah.
you know, really motivated me. I would meet people all walks of life in all moments, different moments of my life, and people who loved A Wrinkle in Time. It was so important to them. And I was extremely curious. I was so curious to try to understand why. Why did A Wrinkle in Time mean so much to so many people? And my curiosity about it is what really drove my motivation to bring it mm-hmm. to fruition. You know, I was curious why I was so moved by A Wrinkle in Time. And I think ultimately I have to say, you know, I did have people that believed in me, most especially outside my family was Madeline L'Engle, and I never wanted to let her down. And mm-hmm. so that's another piece to all of this. You know, you can have you can have something you love, but you also have to have people in your life that are supportive and are there for you and, you know, continue to believe in you. They may mm-hmm. not even like your idea, but they like you. You know, they believe that you have within yourself to be successful in whatever you do. And so that's very important. But I think also the story of A Wrinkle in Time probably became part of my DNA. And one mm-hmm. of the biggest themes is that darkness exists and it can be overcome. So mm-hmm. while I would feel disappointed, I also truly believed that I could overcome it.
Yeah.
You know, I could make
yes.
good on the theme of A Wrinkle in Time. I had to walk the walk. If I was trying to make a movie that darkness exists and it can be overcome, I had to live a life that proved it.
Yes.
And so
yes.
that was part of the journey too.
Right, and the added theme that there's also darkness within us that we need to really be with and heal as well, rather than only projecting it out to what's happening in our environment. Is it
right.
part of the theme as you see it as well?
Say that again.
That you know, Meg realizes that there's also darkness inside of her. It's not just on the outside. And just
yes.
darkness in terms of just, you know, blind spots, let's say.
Right. Yeah. So Madeline was pretty brilliant about not really defining evil or darkness or the black thing.
Right.
And so one of the things that I think did happen over 50 years is that people projected what they wanted to project of what the black
yes.
thing is and what the it is and all those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I came to really understand that it is both internal and
mm-hmm.
external. And
yeah.
I had to overcome both. I had to overcome
yes.
my own sense of lack of confidence, my own insecurities, my feelings of despair. And at the same time, I had to deal with difficulties in working in the entertainment business. My husband died. I had to deal with grief. I mean, so there were... You know, it was both, you know, like it was both internal and external journey And I just hung in there. I just wouldn't give up. And and that's so, I wouldn't give up on my life. I wouldn't give up on A Wrinkle in Time. So there was there's synergy there.
Yeah, I mean, it's really the parallel stories of your life and Meg's story and getting the film made. It's just so fascinating how these themes kind of resonate between your life experiences, which then is informing the film story, which eventually these kind of universals, like, you know, moving forward in the face of adversity, how to learn from disappointment, and how to accept responsibility for our own kind of blind spots. All of these are part of the film as well. So that resonance in your story as it relates to the film story is also what's going to connect with the audience.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I mean, you know, I don't think a book can never be adequately translated for the screen. You know, there are going to be people that will always say, oh, it's not as good as the book. Well, but you always have the book. The book isn't going anywhere. You know, the book will always be in your life. And, you know, part of the reason why I wanted to get this made was that I thought the story, the messages in it, the themes are so rich and timeless that that's the kind of movie I wanted to make. I mean, I thought the story really illuminates the human spirit, and that's always the kind of story I was drawn to. And at the same time, I just had to learn so much in trying to get it made to also teach myself that.
Yes.
You know, one of the things Norman Lear taught me, and I got to say it was really helpful, is that, you know, we all are riding around on the carousel reaching for the brass ring, but the joy is not necessarily in getting the ring. The joy is found in reaching for the ring. And I took that to heart. So just because I didn't get the movie made when I wanted, I was also trying to find joy in the reaching to try to get the movie made.
I think that's it's certainly a valuable lesson for everyone, especially young people who want to get involved in film and television, to really kind of learn how to appreciate the journey, whether there's ups and downs and challenges along the way, but just to understand that, to like take the time to value the journey. And also I think that being grateful to have the opportunity to be creative like this and work with creative teams along the way, you know, it's a blessing. It's a blessing. Well, Catherine, anything else you'd like to...
I was going to say one thing also in that joy for reaching. Norman used to say all the time that when you see a pile of manure, there has to be a pony in there somewhere. and he was always looking for the pony. And I have to tell you, that image, you know, not too graphic, but the idea that you're going to run into so many obstacles, but there's a pony, and go look for the pony. And so many, many times, I didn't like what people had to say, but I had to learn from what they had to say. So if there was some nugget of truth, some insight that someone would say, I really tried to learn from it. You know, I wasn't angry all the time that people didn't want to make the movie. I was trying to figure out, oh, okay, so now how do I have to reframe what I'm saying to get them to change their mind?
Right.
That's what I was doing all the time. How do I persuade someone to come onto the other side of the fence? You know, they're on that side. I want them on the other side. And so it was not about, oh, they're stupid. It was about, what do I have to do? What do I have to say? How do I, you know? And so I never thought it was someone's fault that it wasn't being made. It was like, oh, I just hadn't found the right person yet. I mean, I must have thought that in my head 1,000 times.
Well, it's a you know, it's curious because you and I have talked about the heroine's journey, and it's not really a rite of passage that many people know about. Most people are familiar with Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey, but in the heroine's journey, it's really about that, not only finding your voice and your truth about the film version, but it's also about finding the right tribe in support. And I think this journey that you were on was really about that. You were really kind of finding different ways to express what the film was about as you were kind of on this journey, but ultimately it was about kind of finding the right tribe to make the film. Does that make sense?
Yes. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Another truism in any kind of movies or television is timing. Mm-hmm. You know, you could have a great idea, but the timing isn't right. The timing isn't right for your idea to be brought to fruition, and the timing isn't right to raise money, and the timing isn't right for the cast. I mean, it's always timing.
Mm-hmm.
And in my head, I just always felt that I just hadn't met that team yet. And I think that really, really changed the moment I met Jennifer Lee,
mm-hmm.
The screenwriter for A Wrinkle in Time.
Right.
There was just something about her that I thought, oh, she's going to do it. She's going to crack it. I just know it. I feel it. I just believe it. And Jim Whittaker, the other producer, and Tendo Nagenda, the Disney executive, I mean, it was really like the four of us from the very, very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just this feeling I had. I had been in that place many times before.
Yeah.
But I had never felt the way I did with Jim, Jennifer, and Tendo. There was just something had shifted.
Yeah.
And I just felt very hopeful, more hopeful than I ever felt before.
Yeah, that's that the idea of timing, and I guess another thing, you know, finally, for students who want to get involved in the film and television business, is that it's so important not to give up with the knowledge that when the time is right, the story will be born, the film will be born, or the television series will be born, that we don't have control over that time, but we need to be there and be present when the time comes.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, I read somewhere, I know it's a famous Woody Allen quote,
uh-huh.
Not to use him so much, but he said, you know, 80% of it is showing up. The other 20% is talent. And I think that's really true.
Yes.
You know, it's just it's being in there, it's having, but it's also making friends. It's creating your network. It's having other people read your work. You read other people. Meeting other actors, meeting people that want to be cinematographers. I mean, you know, you need to be building your team.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you won't ever make movies together or television shows together, but you're going to be there for each other. You know, I mean, you think back about George Lucas and Francis Coppola. At one point, I worked for Francis Coppola early in my career. And I got to tell you, you know, being up in San Francisco, it's a very different vibe up there. You don't have agents that always are interfering with whether or not you can read someone's script. And they always read each other's scripts. They always gave each other notes. You know, they didn't make movies together, but they were there for each other. And I think for new storytellers, it's important to not only take a deep dive and learn everything you can about telling a story, but also create your audience. Find the people that love to laugh when you say something funny or cry when you've written something poignant, and that you learn to trust and you have a respect for other people. Because when you have that respect and trust, they can really get you to get better.
Yes.
You know, we aren't all born geniuses. It takes a lot of practice, you know. It just takes so much practice. But I think if you have that group of that circle of people, that changes over time, you know, people come in and out of that circle. But I think it's just really, really important. And it's important to listen to a podcast like this. When I talk about that, you know, it's like listen to everything you can, read everything you can. You know, Norman used to always say, you know, you become the synthesis for your own life. So you take in all this information. People are sharing their stories with you. You're listening to teachers. You're going to classes. You know, all of those kinds of things. And you're writing, always, always writing. Mm-hmm. And then one day you find yourself in the right place at the right time, and wow, it happens.
Yeah. And do you think that showing up is the way to find your community or find your tribe or find the, you know, the support group?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I think that you have to just get in there. You have to find other writers. You have to go to film classes or screenwriting classes, or, you know, you have to be around other people that are trying to do the same thing you are. And you know, another piece to all of that that can also happen, I know this is going to sound crazy, but early in my life, I wanted to be an actress. And and so I was working in Norman Lear's office, and one day there was a call that went out, and about 100 young actresses came in to read for a part, and they all looked like me, sounded like me, and I realized, oh, my God, I'm not that unique. And I don't know, it was kind of in that moment that I was telling someone about this, like it was such an epiphany, and they said, well, maybe what you want to do is be on the other side of the desk. Mm. And I had never thought about that because, first of all, as a young woman back in the 70s, you know, to think that you're going to be a producer or head of a studio or a director,
right?
That was not in the thinking. But when they said that, I started seeing myself more as a producer than an actress. So I think that's why it's also really important to show up and be around other people and share your ideas, because you may find that you love storytelling, but what you really love is makeup, or what you really love is stunt coordination, or what you really love is acting, or what you really love is producing. I mean, you know, it's kind of like, but no matter what you wish to do, if you know the essential elements to good storytelling, you'll go far. That's why I think, you know, all my training as an actress really helped me talk story with writers. Mm-hmm. And I think of the same, you know, for anyone, you know, no matter what job you have in the industry, it's good to be able to, you know, understand the language, the vocabulary that will be spoken around you.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, Catherine, thank you so much. It's so amazing to hear about your journey, and I'm feeling really excited about the the premiere, the opening tomorrow night of A Wrinkle in Time. And I just want to express that I just really admire your courage in following through on your journey and being an inspiration for all of us.
I knew there was a reason why I thought you were so nice when I saw you the other day. I mean, Tom, I've learned so much from you, and we don't have enough time to talk about the heroine's journey, but I have to tell you, your seminar on the heroine's journey was so insightful, and I really learned a lot from it. And so I thank you for all that you do to help me and so many other people become better storytellers.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. And we'll continue our conversation, and I'm also grateful that we've reunited and now can have fun together telling stories.
Yes.
All the best, Catherine. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.